Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of GTI Insights, the Global Taiwan Institute's policy podcast. My name is Marshall Reed, and I'm a program manager here with GTI. And today I'm really thrilled to be joined by Alexandra Dayant, the Deputy Director of the Indo-Pacific Development Center at the Lowy Institute. At Lowy, he conducts really interesting research on international aid, development finance, and geoeconomics, with a particular focus on the Pacific Island states. He also directs the Institute's Pacific Aid Map, which provides a comprehensive overview of all official aid and other development finance flows to the Pacific Islands. He's been a featured speaker at events around the world, and his commentary and research has been really published widely. Alexandra, thanks so much for speaking with me today.
Yeah, thank you. Well, I'm be part of this podcast, and I'm glad to follow the step of my former colleague Natasha Kassam.
Well, I'm so glad to have you here to discuss one of the really most interesting regions in the world for both Taiwan and China, which is the Pacific Islands. Despite their relative geographic isolation, these states really play an increasingly important roles in the diplomatic, economic, and political standoff between Taipei and Beijing. While Taiwan does maintain a really considerable presence in the region, the People's Republic of China has invested heavily there as well, signing numerous bilateral agreements with regional governments and successfully peeling away several of Taiwan's diplomatic partners. With all these developments in mind, I'm so excited to have you here to talk a little bit about Taiwan and China's diverging approaches to the Pacific Islands, regional pushback against Beijing, and look a little bit at the future of Taiwan-Pacific Island cooperation. Well, just to kick things off, I'd love to get a sense of the current landscape in the Pacific Islands. You know, how have regional states traditionally approached Taiwan and China, and has that evolved over time at all?
Yeah, well, that's a good question. Look, I mean, you know, for many, the Pacific or the South Pacific, which is really the region that we look at in Australia, well, it's known for, you know, its pristine beaches, like its beauty, like its cultural diversity and so forth. But it has also like many unique development challenges. And, you know, like there's the dual tyranny of like small size and remoteness make really like conventional economics pathways in most of these countries very difficult. So it is difficult to find an economic growth. It is difficult to just grow economically in those countries. And in addition, you know, like the Pacific has some of the highest population growth rate in the world. And they're getting actually overcrowded in some small island states because of, you know, like they just can't spread the population all across the countries. Like transport systems, infrastructures are very limited. And so all of those really compound with existing development challenges. And in addition, if you want to add to this, you have to think about the fact that, you know, Pacific nations are among the most exposed to natural disasters. And so this threat really is further exacerbated by climate change. So all of those factors combined really make the Pacific one of the most fragile regions in the world and one of the most aid dependent. And so really each Pacific Island countries, you know, they have their own unique set of development challenges. And so they really do value the support from international development partners. And in that regard, you know, like you could argue that the Pacific nations have approached both Taiwan and China as an opportunity to receive additional support to face those economic challenges that I just faced before. So, you know, like, yes, from my little ivory tower of Sydney, I must say that since I've started to analyze the Pacific, I've realized that actually the way Pacific Island countries are engaging with both China and Taiwan has been mostly through the prism of development. And again, you know, both countries really provide an opportunity for additional funding. And it also gives Pacific Island countries an opportunity to leverage the support that non-traditional development partners would give to those countries. But it is true that, you know, like the intensification of China's development program has sparked worries in the West and notably in Australia. Despite the fact that we're seeing this as a worry sometimes to see, like, you know, Chinese development project being, you know, just being implemented all across the region, where actually, you know, like Australia would see this region as like its sphere of influence, of its very grossly, some people say it's like Australia's patch. It has generated a huge benefit to Pacific Island countries.
Well, I think that's a great jumping off point. I do want to delve a little bit deeper into China's changing approach to the Pacific Islands, particularly on aid. But first, I want to delve a little bit deeper into Taiwan and its position in the region. Despite the fact that Taiwan has seen its list of formal diplomatic allies around the world dwindle in recent years, the Pacific Islands region has really been kind of a diplomatic stronghold for Taiwan, with four of its 13 remaining allies located there. Curious to hear, you know, why have regional states continued to align themselves with Taiwan? What do these states gain from their relationship with Taipei? I mean, what do they expect from Taiwan?
Yeah, well, that's a good question. I mean, I think it's important, as you mentioned, it's important to mention that Taiwan has four diplomatic allies in the Pacific. So Nauru, like a country called Nauru, Tuvalu, Palau, and the Marshall Islands. And those are actually tiny nations in the Pacific. But, you know, what's interesting in the world of international relations, and when you look at, you know, when you look at the United Nations, for instance, is that the weight of a vote of Nauru, which is an island of like 10,000 people, is actually as heavy as the one of a nation like India. And so in a way, you could argue that, you know, having the support of those four diplomatic allies in the Pacific is a good thing for Taiwan. But you have to think about what is it for Pacific Island nation with respect to Taiwan. I mean, what do Pacific Island nation get from Taiwan? And as I mentioned before, you know, I think like there are many different ways in which Taiwan contributes to Pacific Island nations. But one I would like to focus on today is really the one that has to come with, you know, aid and development. Taiwan has an aid program, notably through like its Ministry of Foreign Affairs and Trade, but it has also a branch called the Taiwan ICDF, which is basically the equivalent of the US aid of Taiwan. And the Taiwan ICDF is actually pretty, it's quite active in the Pacific, and it's quite active in the four countries that we mentioned before. And you know, you said like we don't want to always compare to China and Taiwan, but I think actually the Pacific is one of the regions where you could do this, especially in terms of development program. Because, you know, like China's contribution to the Pacific region far outstrips that of Taiwan. At the Lowy Institute, the think tank in which I work, I have created this tool called the Pacific Aid Map that traces development finance from the international community to the Pacific. So you can really compare what China and Taiwan give to the region. And despite the fact that actually, you know, like China's aid program to the Pacific is much bigger than Taiwan, the Taiwanese one. One thing we've realized is that on a per capita basis, Taipei actually spends twice as much as China in the Pacific. So if you want numbers, it's around like $237 per Pacific Islander that Taiwan gives, in comparison to $108 that Beijing gives to its, you know, it's the country that supports China. And this is mostly due to the fact that, yes, like the countries that support China in the Pacific are much bigger than the countries that recognize Taiwan. But still, I think it's, you know, it's very important. And I think like the difference between what Taiwan does very well in the Pacific is that it is very good at Taiwan and Taipei are very good at identifying key areas of Pacific development where, you know, the smaller contribution of Taiwan can actually create large impact. So Taiwan really focuses on projects in like the agriculture sector, the health sector, some industry basically that are less captivating than you know, the large scale construction projects that are delivered by China. But they really emphasize Taiwan's advantage, which is like its people to people relationship. Just for the sake of timing, I'm not going to like list you all the projects that Taiwan is involved in, but like really, like if there's one project I really liked, it's one project in the Marshall Islands called the Taiwan's Horticultural Project, where basically Pacific Islands, sometimes they have like a very poor soil and they experience severe droughts that really lead them to a high dependence on imported food. Really, they can't grow actually food well on some of those islands. And as I mentioned before, you know, they're isolated from the rest of the world, so it can be difficult for them. And in addition to this, this has led to, you know, like the increase in non-communicable disease, such as obesity, for instance. And so Taiwan really recognizes those issues. And through this, you know, this Taiwanese horticulture project, Taiwan has sought to increase the sustainable productive capacity of the local population of the Pacific through, you know, training workshops, internships and extended foreign missions by Taiwanese envoy. And I think this is very important because this increased exposure by local Pacific communities to Taiwanese emissaries, if you want, is a key element driving Taiwanese aid. You know, the working relationships that arise create such a goodwill that this lead to basically lengthy cooperation. And when you compare this to Chinese project, Well, you know, like a Chinese project in the Pacific actually facing quite a lot of criticism for, because, you know, China is, for instance, importing its labor workforce, or some of the projects are actually not, you know, not following great standards and don't really pay attention to what Pacific Island needs, really. So, yes, I think this is like the greatest strength that Taiwan brings to the region, is its development program, but also like its people-to-people connection.
Well, again, I think that's a really great overview. And it has been interesting in recent years watching as Taiwan has, you know, worked to refine its approach to the Pacific Island specifically, but also refine its approach to development aid, development finance more broadly. I do want to delve a little bit deeper into China's approach to the region. You know, as you've discussed already, China has made significant inroads in the region in recent years. It's signed agreements. It's been able to pull some of Taiwan's diplomatic allies to its side. I'd be curious to hear from your perspective, what are Beijing's goals for the region? You know, are they purely diplomatic? Are they economic? Are they security focused? What does Beijing hope to gain from increasing its investment in the Pacific Islands?
Yeah. Well, I mean, look, it's funny. Like, so I started working on the Pacific 7 years ago, 6.5 years ago, and I thought I'd be working in the Pacific, but basically I started to work on China in the Pacific for a long time. And the first thing to note is that actually, you know, China has always had a presence in the Pacific. I mean, ethnic Chinese have resided in the region for centuries, running some of the region's oldest trading posts. And so, in a way, you know, like for centuries, the Chinese population has been growing steadily. And this population has grown even more like over the past few decades. And as a result, I think one of the first interests of Beijing, of China in the region, is really like the protection of its diaspora. It is one of the first justification for its presence in the region. And in a way, it's justified, you know, like, I mean, when you look at the riots that that occurred in Solomon Islands in 2021, you know, the anger was clearly directed at the Chinese community. And you could see that, you know, the rioters destroyed part of the local Chinatown. And the same thing actually happened in 2006, you know, during the riots again in Solomon Islands, but also in Tonga, where, again, Chinese businesses were looted and houses were burnt and destroyed. So, yes, like the first, I think one of the first reason justification for China to be in the region is really like to protect its diaspora. The second thing is very much as you mentioned, right? An economic reason. I think the reason that, you know, the Pacific is attractive to China is because Beijing is constantly on the hunt for raw material. With, you know, like the Pacific with its natural resources such as fisheries and extended logging and an extensive exclusive economic zone. Well, this Pacific, you know, they represent an economic opportunity that is worth investing in. And this is why, like, we're seeing more and more Chinese state-owned enterprise being involved in the Pacific. And, you know, since 2006, you know, Chinese trade and commercial activity in the Pacific region has really been steadily and significantly scaling up. And, you know, excluding Papua New Guinea for now, you know, the two-way trade with China has overtaken that of Australia since 2013. Australia used to be, like, the dominant trading partner in the region until really China really boosted its activity. And, you know, most notably, like when you look at the Solomon Islands, the two-way trade between China and the country is like 46%. I mean, all of this to say that China is like becoming a really important active player in the region. But what we see that China is importing way more of Pacific products and Pacific good and raw material than it is exporting to the region. And obviously, this is a product of the fact that China is a huge economy, whereas like Pacific Islands countries are pretty small. So yeah, so protection of the diaspora would be one of the reasons. The economic interest is the second reason. And the third reason I would mention for the sake of this podcast is a foreign policy reason. And this is that, you know, China is interested in the Pacific to promote and fight for its One China policy. So since the 1970s, you know, the battle for recognition between the PRC and Taiwan has really migrated to the Pacific. And today, as you mentioned before, you know, like four of the 14 diplomatic allies of Taiwan are in the region. Actually, in 2019, six of the 16 diplomatic allies of Taiwan were in the region. But in 2019, two countries decided to switch diplomatic allegiance. Solomon Islands was one, and the other one was Kiribati. This is really that those like three interests will really be like the one driving China's interest in the region. One thing I would add very quickly is that, again, looking at the region from afar, in some ways, like I would say that, you know, China could be using a little bit the Pacific as an area where to try to exert influence and see what the reaction of other foreign powers could be in the region. For instance, what would the international community do if China was to invest in a large infrastructure project in X, Y, and Z countries? Well, you'd see like how the like China by you know investing in large facilities such as harbor or like or airport or so forth. You see how the international community reacts. You know, in Australia, for instance, we're playing guacamole, really, where we try to basically counter the Chinese offer every time we can. And so I think China looks at how the community reacts in the Pacific and maybe tries to take those lessons to apply in some other parts of the world, very much like, you know, in Africa or Southeast Asia. So, yeah, so I think this is why, you know, China is really genuinely interested in the region.
I want to latch on to something you said there, that part of Beijing's approach to the region could be motivated by sort of probing and trying to gauge the reaction by regional states to its moves. Just last year, the PRC really made headlines around the world when they signed a really controversial security pact with the Solomon Islands. And I think that did generate an interesting response from countries both in the region and really around the world. Could you talk a little bit about the implications of the deal? You know, was this just China probing to get a response, or is it a sign of a, you know, more concerted, broader effort for China to establish itself as a major security force in the region?
Yeah, this is a good one. Look, the agreements of this China Solomon Island Security Agreement was signed in April 2022, and it has raised a lot of concern among security pundits in Australia, but also in Washington. And mostly about, you know, like it was pure translation of China's growing influence in the Pacific and its potential military presence. I've actually, you know, in preparation for this podcast, I've actually extracted part of the draft security agreement just so that your listener can understand what this security agreement between China and the Solomon is about. So the draft security agreement says that China may, according to its own needs and with the consent of the Solomon Islands, make ship visits to carry out logistical replenishment and stopover and transition in Solomon Islands. And the relevant forces of China can be used to protect the safety of Chinese personnel and major projects in Solomon Islands. And I think, look, I mean, when you read this, it is clear that, you know, it sounds like, yeah, China will have actually an access to the Solomon Islands. And this, in a way, is a massive issue for the Australian government, because it means that basically the Chinese Communist Party and the PLA could have really like a presence just in front of Australia. This has been one of the biggest threats for the security environment in Australia, and it has really translated in 2022 by this agreement. I think this is, you're right, in a way, this is the translation of China's strategic involvement in the region and what was like the intent of China in the Pacific. But at the same time, I think it's important to understand that the risk of a Chinese military base on the doorstep of Australia is actually very low. And this is for a few reasons. And I think like those reasons actually are mostly domestic, and it's about the Solomon Islands. The first thing is that securing property is actually challenging in Solomon Islands, which is a country where nearly 90% of the land is what you call customary owned, meaning that rights to land are entitled and regulated by customary systems of tenures and of illegal, and it's basically illegal to sell and lease to foreigners. So it means that it will be illegal and lease to Chinese people. So that's the first thing. The second reason is that, you know, the potential for protest and unfavorable election outcome is likely to discourage the Solomon Island government from agreeing to establish a military base in the country. I think those two domestic issues, hurdles really, will actually prevent the Solomon Island government to allowing the Chinese to set up a military base in the country. And then I think when this security agreement was signed between China and the Solomon Islands, it really raised alarm bells everywhere in the West. And you could see that, you know, the US had reacted pretty quickly, Australia, New Zealand, and so forth. Suddenly we all started to pay way more attention to Solomon Islands. And And now you can see, like, you know, development partners like Australia, the US, and all, everyone is stepping up the game. And this had started a bit before April 2022. But it's still, you know, like, I think by their presence there, you know, like, Western countries are going to actually show that they are and will remain the main, you know, development partners, but also security partners of the region.
Well, no, I agree. Watching the response to that Solomon Islands deal, particularly in DC, was really interesting. It did seem like it really generated a huge response and really directed focus to the Pacific Islands in a way I haven't seen in the past. I want to build on that a little bit and talk a bit about regional pushback against Beijing. You know, despite Beijing's best efforts and their heavy investments in the region, you know, there has been some pushback from, you know, regional organizations, from regional leaders. In February, the Pacific Islands Forum, which is, you know, really a major multilateral player in the region, elected former Nauru president and Taiwan supporter Baron Waka as Secretary General. And then even more recently, we saw outgoing president of the Federated States of Micronesia, David Penuelo, write a really scathing letter to Micronesian leaders outlining the PRC's nefarious efforts to influence the Micronesian government, to push policy in their direction, and pull support away from Taiwan. In the letter, he even called for a switch back to Taiwan. So I'm curious to hear, how consequential are these developments? Are these sort of small, isolated events, you know, do they represent broader dissent against China in the region, or are they just that sort of isolated, relatively inconsequential events?
Yeah, this is a great question. I think, look, like to talk about this, we'll have to, I'd like to, you know, pick up on the two elements that you mentioned. So the election of, you know, the former president of Nauru at the Pacific Island Forum, and after to talk about like Panuelo's letter, because I think like those two elements, you're right, they're connected, but they are to be analyzed separately to understand why there's this pushback of China in the Pacific. The first one is that, you know, like on the election of president of Nauru, Baron Waka, to be the next Pacific Island Forum leaders, secretary general. To me, first, that was a surprise. I think, like, you know, like the character of this former president has had quite a lot of issues legally, and there are some concerns about, you know, bribery in his own countries and so forth. But I think, like, the most important fact about President Waka was that he was a very vocal and very clear and strongly vocal supporter of Taiwan, but also like a vocal opponent of China. I mean, I remember, you know, notably a time when Nauru was hosting the Pacific Island Forum's leaders meeting in, I think it was in 2018, President Waka had demanded China to apologize for a senior envoy's crazy behavior at the forum. And he lashed out at, you know, Beijing's arrogant presence in the region after really like what happened is that the head of China's delegation at the Pacific Island Forum basically attempted to address the meeting. And President Waka really refused to let him speak until the island leaders had finished. And this resulted in, you know, the Chinese delegation leaving the room. And, you know, it doesn't sound such a big drama like this, but at the time, in this kind of instances, this actually was quite a big event. And I think there are a few countries in the Pacific that actually opposed vocally to China's doing. And Nauru and President Waka was definitely one of them. Now, like, you know, we're talking about a push against China. I think this push is concentrated only in few places, not everywhere. Again, because, you know, we talked about the fact that China was actually bringing a lot of development alternatives to Pacific Island countries, development opportunities. This is still true, you know, like, and China also offers basically access to an economic market that is beneficial for Pacific Island countries when they can sell their goods to the Chinese market. So even if it's not that many, it's still something important for Pacific Island countries. So I would say that, you know, yes, there are some countries that are pushing back, like more than countries like characters or politicians that are pushing back against China's presence in the Pacific. So President of Nauru has won. You mentioned, you know, the president of the FSM, the Federal State of Micronesia, David Panuelo. He wrote a letter, a very long letter, that is actually very interesting to read, where basically he accused China of bribery, of threat and interferences. And he was basically putting words on, putting on paper what a lot of people had talked about with respect to China's engagement in the Pacific. You know, as a Pacific analyst, I heard those accusations quite a lot. I heard the fact that, you know, China engaged with Pacific nations not through the traditional systems on which, you know, development like Australia or the US would engage with, which is like, you know, like the diplomatic corps and so forth. China engaged directly with like the political elite and really make deals with prime ministers or the ministers directly rather than like going through like a proper system of scrutiny. And this is something that we've heard about. And this is, something that President Panuelo put in his letter. But I think so those accusations are not new. I think what's important to mention is that China is also like a new kind of, is new in terms of, you know, being a diplomatic actor, a development partner, and is learning from its mistakes. I mean, I specialize on looking at, you know, development funding in the Pacific and in Southeast Asia. And you see the way that China has been engaged in development has actually evolved for the better. You know, some time ago, we were accusing China of debt trap diplomacy. Well, I've actually looked at the numbers and I've realized that China actually has not been engaged in debt trap diplomacy in the Pacific, actually over the past 10 years. But if China continues to behave in the way it has behaved over the past 10 years, during the next 10 years, then yes, those accusations might be funded, but at the moment, they are not. And I think this has to do with like the same thing with respect to diplomacy, you know, like they're learning from their mistakes. They had been playing this wolf warrior, this diplomacy that actually created most of this kind of conflictive interaction with other diplomatic community. And I think China realized this was a mistake. And very much like in the Pacific, they realized that they're making mistakes. They're getting better. Now, like all of what China does in the Pacific is not all pink and beautiful, you know, like they still need to make they still need to improve. They still need to collaborate with other Pacific nations. But I still think that those accusations that we heard from the president of Micronesia or president of Nauru, they are in a way based on truth and based on like things that really happened or like at the feelings that the Pacific communities are experiencing. But I also think that, you know, going forward, we might see China getting a bit better in the way it does development, it does diplomacy and so forth. And now I'd like just to come back very quickly on the final point that you were making on, you know, President Panuelo offering, you know, conversing basically a possible diplomatic switch from Beijing to Taipei. I think this would actually be something very interesting to watch in the next few months, next few years, maybe, you know, like, again, observing the Pacific and, you know, the Taiwan's diplomatic link in the Pacific. Very often we look at the pressure that Pacific Island countries that support Taiwan are facing when they're not supporting China. But whenever you talk about, you know, the other way around, what could happen if a country that supports China starts to recognize diplomatically Taiwan? And I think Micronesia is actually an interesting case because this country is in a compact of free association with the United States, which means that basically the U.S. provides a lot of financial assistance to Micronesia. And to all Pacific Island countries, the Federal State of Micronesia might be the country that has the actually support, enough support from the international community to be able to decline any further Chinese development support to actually receive support from Taiwan and additional support from the international community. So I think this is definitely a case to watch. Now, like the last thing I would say about this letter is that it is coming at the time where the president is leaving his position. And so I think this undermines a little bit the message of the letter. It undermines the weight of the letter because we know that he's doing this while he's leaving the presidency. And there might be like a political reason why or behind the motivation of this letter. So I think it undermines a little bit the message, but it's still an interesting message to read.
Well, Alexander, I think you've done a fantastic job of providing nuance and really giving excellent background on the past and the present of Pacific Island states and their really complex relationships with Taiwan and China. But what I want to do to conclude here is to look forward a little bit and look at the future of how these states deal with China and Taiwan and if that's going to change going forward. From your perspective and, you know, seeing these recent events that we've talked about already, what do you think is going to happen in the region going forward? You know, will China continue to expand its presence or Taiwan be able to maintain and potentially even expand its presence in the region?
Yeah, well, that's a good one. I mean, look, I don't have a crystal ball, so I can't really tell you what's going to happen in the future. One thing I can tell you, though, is that pressure, I think pressure will continue to mount on Taiwan. And I believe the Chinese, you know, the China-Taiwan competition will intensify over the years, mostly due to, you know, Xi Jinping's rejuvenation plan and, you know, like the reunification and so forth. And this comes in the back of the fact that, you know, China is not going anywhere in the Pacific. But Taiwan remains one of the very important diplomatic player in the region. So, yes, so the pressure on Taiwan will continue to mount. But I also need to admit that the West has invested quite dramatically in the region over the past few years. You know, in Australia, we had what we call the Pacific Step Up, which basically meant that Australia's foreign policy started to refocus its attention on the Pacific. And this came with the Pacific Step Up, came like the opening of new diplomatic posts, new funding for the Pacific. And this funding kind of starts to crowd out some of China's, let's say, main advantages in the Pacific. What I mean by saying this is that China focuses a lot on infrastructure. Now Australia is going to do way more on infrastructure, notably through the Pacific Step Up. New Zealand has had its Pacific reset. The US just launched, you know, what you might have heard, what is called the Partner of the Blue Pacific, to create basically new ways to finance development in the region. And this means that basically, in a way, you know, Taiwan will benefit from this because the funding that were traditionally channeled through China on big infrastructure projects now can be financed through the West and through countries that, in a way, support Taiwan. So I think, you know, there'll be a lot of more attention put on the region, and it's definitely going to be, you know, to be interesting to see how like the ties between Taiwan and the Pacific Island countries are going to evolve. Looking at what's going to happen in the Federated State of Micronesia, it's definitely going to be an area of interest for me. And I think, you know, like if you look ahead at what Taiwan should be doing, I think Taiwan should continue to do the exact same that it's doing at the moment, which is concentrating, yeah, like on the people-to-people connection, you know, like sending its own people on the ground, interacting with locals, sharing the knowledge, sharing the technology that they have on agriculture projects, on renewable energy, on some infrastructure, on health. Taiwan is big on health as well. And those actually are, you know, sometimes they are projects that, again, are not as shiny as, you know, a huge infrastructure bridge. But it does build a very strong connection between Pacific Islanders and Taiwanese people. And I think the Taiwanese can't, you know, the Taiwanese aid program is limited. And so according to my studies, what I've realized is that Taiwan is one of the countries that does punch above its weight when it has to do with the way it disbursed its financing and the way it uses its foreign support to gain soft power. This works very well, and I think so. This is why, like, I think Taiwan should continue to do well the thing that it does well, and to continue to focus on this. That's going to be the way forward for Taiwan in the Pacific.
Well, I think it's a great place to bring the conversation to a close. I think it's been a really great discussion, and you've done such a great job of shedding light and providing nuance about these countries and this region that's really becoming increasingly significant for the foreign policies of both Taiwan and China. You know, despite their small size and, you know, relative geographic isolation, these Pacific Island states really do play an outsized role in both regional and global geopolitics. That's been really fascinating to watch what they've done and what they will do going forward. So I think you've given us a great background and really provided a great foundation for those of us who want to learn more about this region. So, Alexandra, thanks so much for speaking with us today.
Well, thank you very much for having me, Michael.
And thank you to all our listeners for joining us for another episode of GTI Insights. Many thanks also to the great staff and interns at GTI for all their help with every step of producing this podcast. If you're interested in learning more about GTI, be sure to check out our website at globaltaiwan.org, where you can find more information about our Global Taiwan Brief and our frequent public seminars. You can also listen to more episodes of GTI Insights on Spotify, Google Podcasts, and wherever else you get your podcasts. Until next time, this has been GTI Insights.